Ramsey TV.
I thank you, all of you, of course. Thank God for all of you who support and love us. But today I got to especially send a shout out and love to Waylon and Regina Dabbs, who are back in Florida now. They live about 17, 20 miles from here in Coral Springs. But they invited Maria and me to dinner. And I'm telling you, never did we need it more. Never did we need it more than today. What an instinct these two had. It took us to a nice place. And, you know, I went to the wound specialist today. And, you know, like usual, they just wound your wound. You know, nothing was better. The only thing that takes the pain away is if I double what I'm supposed to take on my meds, which is not good. But I have to do it. Double it. Sorry. Not into pain that much, you know. But you know, but this show is an analgesic, as you know, is the best painkiller. But also their company, the company of Waylon and Regina. Maria and I had such a great time with them tonight. It's very late tonight. I never make a show this late. It's 9:10 p.m. on Thursday. So this, I guess this will be Friday's show, which will end the week. I got really down today after I got back. After Maria went with me, of course. We go with each other everywhere. She went with me, and I was my charming self at the doctor's. But then after that, I really got down. And whenever I'm down, I usually take Kratom. But I don't take it anymore. I'm off of it. So then I got nothing in it. It's a little panicky, and I just got really low. Fortunately, you know, Waylon and Regina invited us out. So, because I don't feel like a regular person anymore. Once this hits you, once this stuff hits you, your whole life is like doctors. And it's just so sickening. It's horrible, really. You start to prefer death, really. You really do start to prefer death. It's such a clusterfuck of... Your whole world now becomes your health. And that's the most boring... most disgusting, most uninteresting topic I can even ever think of. Remember, I've taught many times on the temple tax that Jesus and Peter paid. Peter put that hook in the Sea of Galilee to pull out the coin that will pay the temple tax for both him and his master. The temple tax was an insult to Israel because they had to pay for the upkeep of their own temple, which in the millennium, it will be the responsibility of the nations to upkeep Israel's temple. So it's an insult for them, slap in the face, that they have to upkeep their own temple. They're supposed to be served by the nations. Instead, they're this lowly nation that's spit on by the nations. But their fortunes will change during the millennium, obviously. Our fortunes, too. We have to pay to maintain these bodies and to finally be delivered from worrying about them. I mean, to fuss over them. Oh, my God. I'm so sick of it already. It's horrible. I'm so sick of it already. So, shout out Waylon and Regina. They just dropped us off back home about 20 minutes ago. We had a great time. And I felt normal. They really made me feel like I was a regular person again. I just haven't felt that way. So I'm going to go back to 2 Timothy. Going to get to the scriptures quick here. Going to go to 2 Timothy. My wife says, what are you going to talk about today? I said, 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 2. I'm going to take four words. Yeah, four words. I'm going to expand on them from a section I wrote in the book, The Lie of Every Man's Battle. I regret the title of this book. I may yet change it. I think I might change it to Christianity's War Against Men. See, that's a more engaging, more violent, more inspiring title. The Lie of Every Man's Battle. I just thought that maybe if I brought the name of the enemy's book, Every Man's Battle, the Christian book, in there, people searching for Every Man's Battle might find The Lie of Every Man's Battle. I don't know if that's true or not. But listen to what Paul says. In verse 22, I'll start with verse 21. That's where I left off yesterday in 2 Timothy 2:21. If then anyone should be purging himself from these, well, from what? I got to start with verse 20. In a great house. Now, he's talking about back in 1 Timothy, the God's house. How we behave in God's house. And he's naming all these offices in God's house. But God's house has become the great house full of vessels of honor and dishonor. And then purging yourself from these. Now, in a great house, Paul says, and this is a direct reference to the to God's house in 1 Timothy. But things have changed. The apostasy has set in big time. Now, in a great house, there are not only gold and silver utensils, but wooden and earthenware also. Some indeed for honor, some for dishonor. So the dishonorable, the bad apples have infiltrated God's house. And it's destroyed it. To the point that Paul says in verse 21, if then anyone should be purging himself from these, he will be a utensil for honor, hallowed and useful to the owner, made ready for every good act. Useful to the owner is now those who herald the word, stand by it opportunely and inopportunely, expose, rebuke, and entreat. Study the word to show themselves approved and rightly divide the word of truth. All these great phrases are in 2 Timothy because now it is rightly dividing the word of truth, studying to show yourself approved, that gets you progress in the things of the Spirit. It's no longer, unfortunately, it's no longer a gathering, local gathering, local ecclesias. God just broke that up, just like he broke up Zender, Sheridan, and Pilkington back in the day. 3 years we were on fire and people loved it, but God doesn't want that. So he broke it up and now it's every man and woman for him or herself. Now the next statement in verse 22 is shocking. I am really hot. I want to take off this jacket. I wore this jacket because I wanted to feel like a decent, nice human being, but I'm sweating to death here. Please excuse me. Okay, that's better. All right, yeah, this is better. What do we have? Verse 22. Now, youthful desires flee. What do you think of when you hear that verse? You think of one thing and one thing only. Youthful desires flee. Quit looking at girls, Timothy. We know you have a one-track mind. There are other things in the world besides women. Youthful desires, run away from your youthful desires. I mean, that's all we think about. But I learned something from Clyde Pilkington's book, The Church in Ruins, that the youthful desires Paul's teaching about, he's in the whole context here, is about, in verse 15, endeavor to present yourself to God qualified and unashamed worker, correctly cutting the word of truth. From profane prattling, stand aloof. That's verse 16. Talks about the great house. So he's talking about the world of the ecclesia. And then he says, youthful desires flee. Just after talking about purging oneself from an ecclesia, from a structure, from an outward structure that has vessels of honor and dishonor in it. And now it's every man and woman for him or herself. So the context here, where is there a sexual context anywhere near here? There's not a sexual context. You have to go a long way to find any sexual context. The context is religion. Context is trying to maintain God's house when the apostasy is set in and there's no more such thing as God's house. I learned that from Clyde Pilkington's book, The Church in Ruins. And I wrote a chapter on it in my book, The Lie of Every Man's Battle, which I wrote with Heidi Koppel, my co-author. There she is, beautiful woman, mother of four, wife of husband Danny, and four kids. There she is. There I am in the back of the book. Anyway, I should rename this Christianity's Attack Against Men. War. No, Christianity's War Against Men. What do you think? Let me know what you think. This chapter is called Religious Lust, and this is the overlooked lust. I'm not going to get all through this today because I'm tired. I'm already at 9 minutes, but To the authors of Every Man's Battle, sexual desire, lust. And by the way, I need to tell you this. Youthful desires flee. Desires, why the Concordant version had to split this up, I don't know. Same damn word in the Greek for lust. Sometimes they made it desire, sometimes they made it lust. I don't know why they did that. Make it one way. If I want two different words for one Greek word, I'll go to the King James version. Anyway, youthful lusts flee. That's what this says. To the authors of Every Man's Battle. This is from page, if you don't have this book, get it. It's a really important book. From page 325. To the authors of Every Man's Battle, sexual desire, lust, is the worst kind of desire existent. Never mind that, without it, no one ever marries. Without sexual desire, the race dies. You know, so what's so bad about sexual desire? Without sexual desire, none of us would be here. Never mind that those who abuse sexual desire are a minority. I believe so. Compared to all the Earth's inhabitants who get hungry every day, only a minority become clinical gluttons. So how many people criminally rape women, serially rape women and dismember them in their basement? Like, okay. But according to people like James Dobson, if you just look at a picture of a beautiful woman, say a naked woman in a men's magazine, it inevitably leads to serial rape, serial murder, and dismembering women in your basement. Inevitably, it just always happens, according to people like James Dobson. They're idiots. Anyway, because Otterburn and Stoker consider sexual desire a spiritual enemy rather than a natural function, they strive to condemn it, and that's all they do in their book. Historically, religion baits its victims into battling legitimate instincts, such as the book Every Man's Battle. They entice men and boys to withstand legitimate instincts. Religious people, hoping to please God with their own efforts, mistakenly assume that God hates life's basic pleasures. Oh, anything that gives you pleasure, God hates and you must turn away from, especially in the sexual department. Religious people are so busy trying to please God, they're unaware that God already could not be more pleased with them through Christ. Religion addicts, and that's what we're talking about. People who go to church are religion addicts. They're not holy people. They're not people who love God. They're religion addicts. Religion addicts typically fear their flesh. They're afraid of offending God and can only have a good day when they imagine that they are conquering their flesh. Whenever their flesh betters them, which every 5 minutes, away goes their peace. They have no peace. As soon as they sin, they have no peace. See, we have peace even when we sin, because we understand Romans 6, 7, and 8. Thus, their peace is based not upon Christ, but upon controlling their flesh. Christian peace does not depend upon Christ and what he has stated to be true concerning you, that you are justified, that God loves you no matter what. No, it's not based on that. It's based on controlling the flesh. Therefore, Christian peace rises and falls with the ability of the flesh to conquer itself to please God. Otterburn and Stoker, the authors of this horrible book, Stephen Otterburn and Fred Stoker, I'm guessing were raised in a thou shalt not religious environment which condemned natural instincts. I have to believe that. Either that or they were raised in a healthy family and were eventually waylaid by a law-keeping church. Could have happened too. Do I have any cough drops? I really need something for my voice. Hang on a second. I'm going to be right back. Entertain yourselves while I'm away. I should have brought one in. Hang on for a second. Without sugar in it, so I got this Ricola Swiss Alpine herbs. Look at that, sugar free, great tasting, effective relief. We'll see about that. It does make my throat feel better. Let's see if I can talk better after this. Come on, work it for me, suck it down. Come on, let's go. Work it. Getting better. Okay. I'm out here when I get there. Arterburn and Stoker. My theory. They were raised in a thou shalt not religious environment, which condemned natural instinct. Either that, or they were raised in a healthy family and were waylaid by a law-keeping church. Like my son Paul was. Waylaid by a law-keeping church. I contend it is religion that makes addicts out of normal people. It is a strapping of unnatural restrictions upon people's backs that makes these people desire to an unhealthy degree that which is prohibited. We will elaborate upon this further in a future chapter. And we do that. I'm going to finish with this section because I'm shot tonight. There we go. This section is called The Temptation to Achieve. People forget this as a lust. This is religious lust. Religious lust is more damning, more condemning than sexual lust. Think of it. Everybody has some kind of sexual lust. If we believe that even in the circumcision evangel, God forgives sins, right? Let's say that sexual lust is a sin. It's not. It all depends on the context, okay? Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. God forgives sins. Even in the circumcision evangel, you confess your sins to God and he forgives, right? So you don't lose your aeonian life. But religious desire, the temptation to achieve for God, the thought that you're actually impressing God and must impress God with your own fleshly attempts at righteousness, that disqualifies from aeonian life. So that is a sin worse than sexual lust, even the worst of sexual lust, religious lust. And nobody ever thinks of this. Religious lust. The temptation to achieve. Listen to this. I'll read this section, then I gotta bail. The power hold of religion turns nice people into insufferable finger pointers. The most difficult people in this world are those who think they've arrived at some plateau of moral perfection. Then wonder why the rest of us can't imitate them. What's the matter with the rest of you people? These kinds of people cannot help looking down their noses at the poor sinners, quote, farther down the mountain, unquote. When this religious spirit runs amok, a mere looking down the nose is not enough. Since God does not seem very good today at condemning lazy Christians, because God's conciliated to the world, then those who think they are super Christians will take that duty upon themselves. They will condemn. The sinner will be punished. Either by snubbing backstabbing, or where the religious spirit infects a nation or a mob, murder. Today, religion is a profitable business. Needless to say, ladies and gentlemen, conferring power upon willing workers, useful idiots if you like. These days, those addicted to attaining God's favor manually can officially set themselves as judges over the rest of us. With a little work, the religious achiever can back up his or her moral assumptions by earning a robe, attaining a white collar, or starting a church. Others can obtain more degrees than Nebuchadnezzar's ovens. Master of Divinity has a particularly devastating ring to it. I'm a Master of Divinity. What are you? Nothing. And then they can write books. There's nothing like an MDIV notation after one's name to shush the rubble into awestruck silence. Thus, sexual lust is not the most powerful lust in the world, nor the most dangerous. Neither is the lust for drink. Ah, ladies and gentlemen, there is a far stronger lust, ensnaring far more people and wreaking far more havoc upon the world than that which merely craves gin or G-strings. The lust of which I speak is so insidious and yet so subtle that those under its influence claim God as their greatest ally. At its most common level, this lust condemns. Later, it kills. Throughout, it walks upon water, or thinks it does, unaware of people drowning at its feet. On Monday through Thursday, it prays in pious tones. On Friday, it kills God's son.